You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, open source, grassroots, community, solar-powered radio, broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in Fairfield. And this is Writers' Voices, our first one for the new year. Welcome. It's really good for me to be back. I want to, first of all, give a great thank you to my guest host, Cheryl Fusco Johnson, who filled in several weeks during December while I was gone, and she did a wonderful job, and that was greatly appreciated. I, of course, am Monica Hadley, back again, and normally I'd be sitting here next to my wonderful mother, Caroline Kilborn, but due to the weather and some other incidences, she wasn't able to make it into the station today, so I'm flying solo. But I have a great guest today that I'm sure going to make this very easy for me. Our guest today, well, let me start out this way. Have you ever experienced an epiphany, a life-changing moment, or realization? Elise Ballard did and was so stunned by its effect on her life that she started asking others if they had ever experienced these kinds of breakthroughs. What began as simple curiosity led to an unexpected and exciting journey spanning several years and the breadth of human experience. The result is Epiphany, a collection of more than 50 revelations that changed lives and the lives of others forever. Elise Ballard is an actress, an independent filmmaker, and film producer. She started her career in entertainment in New York, Austin, and Los Angeles. Austin is where I've been spending some time lately with my children and grandson. Her work as a producer began in Los Angeles and as a partner in production company that produced films distributed by Lionsgate and Monarch Entertainments. So we'll talk a little bit about her background in filmmaking as well, but the focus today is this book, Epiphany, True Stories of Sudden Insight to Inspire, Encourage, and Transform. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Elise.
Oh, thank you so much. It's so great to be here.
So let's just start out from the top. Why did you write this book?
I wrote the book because, well, the first thing that happened was I had an epiphany. And I, as you talk about my filmmaking, a couple of months later, in the moment when I had my epiphany, I didn't realize I'm having an epiphany. But a couple of months later, my life was so different that I woke up one day and I flashed back to that moment and went, that was an epiphany. And I was so amazed that this one instant, literally one instant, had completely changed the course of my life, that I started asking people if they had ever had an epiphany. I would ask my friends and colleagues, and then I do, as a filmmaker, a lot of behind-the-scenes work or verite documentary work. And so when I'd be working, I would started asking people on camera, on the fly, not giving them any time to think about it. And even when I wasn't giving people time to think about it, I was getting the most interesting, compelling answers and people talking about this phenomenon. So as time went on, I just thought, you know, maybe I'll cobble these interviews together into a film and go do the festival circuit and sell them on the web like I do my other films. And then one thing led to another. I thought, you know, we could spin these off into a book, you know, the best ones into a book. And someone had wanted to develop it into a reality show and documentary. So as I was developing the television treatment for it, I started thinking more and more about the book because I was interviewing people on the phone as well. And one thing led to another, and the book is the thing that just kept going. So that's how I ended up with this beautiful book on my desk right now.
It is a beautiful book. I love the colors. It's this, what kind of blue do you call that, your jacket cover?
I think, you know, I consider it a deep sky blue. I thought, yeah, I agree with you. They did a great job. The publisher designed it. I think it did a great job.
Wow.
I was very pleased. But yeah, I think it's like a deep sky blue. It's perfect for epiphanies, isn't it?
It is. It is. In fact, it's, yeah, it's the color of the sky that when I was just down in Arizona over Christmas, and they have very deep blue sky down there, and it's very similar to this. And then you've got this bright kind of lime, not quite lime green, kind of, I don't know, in between something else and lime.
A
exclamation
yellow.
Point.
Like a chartreuse.
Yeah. Yes, like a chartreuse. Chartreuse is one of my favorite words.
I know, isn't it? It's the best.
It's a word that you don't really hear very often, but every time I hear that word, I flash back to about fifth or sixth grade, being at band camp. The school I went to, we had a band camp, and every part of it every summer, at the end of camp, we had a skit contest. And I remember doing this skit with my friends where we sang this song about three chartreuse buzzards.
That is hilarious. And it's a very hard word to spell. I always misspell it.
Yeah. Well, thank goodness for spell check.
Exactly. Thank God for Google.
Yes. Yeah.
Google words. Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting that you ended up with a book when you started out with film, you know, the idea of making a documentary or a reality show, and that's your background. So what is it that do you think that really led you to make a book out of this? What was there anything specific or just?
Well, you know, the gentleman that was my friend who was running a production company at the time, and he's the last story in the book, and he actually was running a Christian-based production company, but I would just sort of, he sort of was a colleague and mentor of mine, and I was in New York, I'd never told anyone the idea. I'd just been asking a few people when I was working, and I'd never told anyone about the idea, and we'd had dinner. And I just mentioned it to him, like, what do you think about this idea I have? Because I just interviewed someone behind the scenes, and I had asked them on the fly. And again, what I found with these stories is that I would ask someone the question, they tell me their story, and then I would find myself really thinking about the story later. Unexpectedly, it would come to mind. And I would be contemplating these stories, and I realized they were just so powerful, you know, and I was learning from them and utilizing this wisdom that people had gained from their epiphanies in my life. And I was like, I may have something here that other people might enjoy and find valuable. So when I talked to him about it, he said, you know, I think The Secret had just come out. This was in August of 07, I think, or 08. And he said, you know, you could spin off the best ones into a book. And I was like, oh, yeah. And then we just went on. And then as I was developing the television treatment, I was interviewing people on the phone. And I'd never done that before. I've always interviewed people, you know, in person, on camera.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, I remember having the thought. I was interviewing Larry Wright, Lawrence Wright. He's in my book. And he was the first person I ever officially interviewed on the phone for the project that I said, this is the project I'm doing. You know, what do you think about it, and would you be interested? And he was, and he loved it, and was very encouraging, and gave me this interview, my first interview. And I had to develop these interviews for the television treatment. I remember thinking, I can do this much faster than the way I've been doing it with video, or on film, because you have to organize a shoot, et cetera. And I remember just kind of thinking about that, and then when the television documentary idea for the people that I was developing it with, they're a Christian-based organization, and they came back to me and said, listen, we only want the Epiphanies to be Christian. Mm. And I was getting Christian Epiphanies, and I love Christian Epiphanies, but I wanted to know everybody's epiphany. I'm interested in all belief systems, all walks of life, people from everywhere, and, you know, all different kinds of beliefs. So we parted ways amicably, and so I was in New York shooting for Dr. Oz and Dr. Roizen, and I met with people that I knew, and I said, you know, do you know any lit agents? And then I got to lit agents, and I met with a publisher, and everyone was really interested in it and asked me to get a book proposal together. So I had to figure out how to do that, and see, just one thing led to another. And as I say in the book, you know, when you have an epiphany and you believe in it and you take action on it, you'll find that serendipity comes into play. And I would say and I talk about this project as now being my greatest epiphany in life, because, you know, serendipity happened over and over and over again that we have this book and that we're talking about it right now. Because I'd never written anything. I've written my whole life, but I never showed anybody. I have literally boxes of journals, and short stories and poems and different stuff I've written and different short scripts. I mean, I've shown people my scripts I've written, I guess, but I've never done a feature script. I've just done these short scripts. And but, you know, this was the one that I started showing people and So, and I got a book deal. So it's been, and that, I believe this project, again, it's been so, I call it, it has its, a little mind of its own. So it found its way into a book first, and we launched a website with a lot of the interviews that I filmed. I still film a lot of the interviews because I've always seen this as a website project. Because of the wonderful times we live in right now, the technology that we have, we actually can go find out about people's epiphanies from all over the world, from all walks of life. You know, people in remote villages in Africa are emailing me. Literally, everyone, I mean, not everyone, but more and more people are having access to the internet and are, you know, we're able to go and see what each other has to say, no matter who we are. So it was a very important component to this project to have a website with filmed interviews and written interviews. And so we have that, and now we have the book first before a film or a reality show.
Wow.
So that's been my trajectory with the book.
So you really didn't think of yourself as a writer, per se?
No.
Do you think that the success that you've had getting this book published, will that lead you to show some of your other writings, maybe see if some the other things that you've written can be published?
Yes. Well, you know what happened was when I got interest in Epiphany as a book, and people were reading my treatment and such, and I had written up the stories shorter than they are now, but, you know, I had written up and I had really had to shape these interviews and the stories behind it and, you know, and writing the vision of the project, et cetera. And so when I got such great feedback from that, it gave me a little more confidence. And then so when I knew that I was going to be pitching and all this, I went and I started taking a writing class. So I've taken two writing classes. And actually one other time, I did this other movie called Lord of the Weens that I can't remember if you talked about it in the biography, but it's a film that I've done that still sells on Amazon and on my website, and it ran on PBS, and it's crazy. It's about the wiener dog races in Butte, Texas, and it was really the first film I did as a director, as a filmmaker on my own accord. And so in doing that, the guys that helped me do that had funded the wiener dog races, they're a marketing company, and they had really helped me with the artwork and such, and they had come up with the name Lord of the Weens for the wiener dog races that year. So then I made up a documentary, D-A-C-H, on a word pun on dachshunds. So I had developed a relationship with them, and he teaches writing. So they had invited me to take a class with them. So that was the first class I ever took, and that was in 2007, and I had never read anything I had done out loud. And one of the assignments was to write a 200-word piece on something we'd seen. We went and saw the gentleman who ran the National Endowment for the Arts in Austin, and we spoke about what we experienced in hearing him speak. And I had to read two pieces I wrote out loud. And the feedback I got from that, Roy Williams, and he's in the book, and he said to me, he looked at me after I read my thing out loud, and he said, "You could be making a living at this right now."
Wow.
And I went, "Really?" And I blew it off. I didn't believe it. You know, another thing, like I talk about epiphanies, is one of the things this has done for me is that I believe in myself so much more because of this project, and also because of all the stories that people tell about that. And I didn't really believe in myself or in my ability to write. And so then I took a couple of classes when people were interested in it as a book when I was writing the proposal. When I was developing the proposal, I took a couple of classes out here in L.A. And again, it was creative writing, and I had to read my stuff out loud, and the feedback I got from people encouraged me, and gave me more and more confidence. So I did take a couple of classes, and then I had to get the proposal done, and I had a wonderful agent that sort of helped. She used to be an editor, and she really helped me do that. She did a lot of editing and shaping the proposal with me, so I learned a lot from her. And then, you know, I had this wonderful editor at Random House when I got my book deal, and I worked with another editor too on the side that's a friend of mine that helped me. So people have helped me, but yeah, this was the first time that I ever had really. This is the first public showing, but I did talk. I did read my work and submit work in these classes that I took. So that did give me the encouragement to know, like, to keep going and to know that people were responding to what I was writing. So, and I knew that my friends did. I would sometimes read these short stories and these journal entries that I had to my friends because it was about us and it would make us laugh, or, you know, it was about men, you know, heartbreak. And they knew it. And so, and they would be moved by it. But I never knew. It was just because they knew me and knew the situation. So that's been my journey with it. It's all sort of happened in some ways fast, but in some ways I looked back and I've been writing my whole life. You know, since I'm 8, I've been keeping a journal. So.
Well, you're listening to Writer's Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Elise Ballard, the author of Epiphany, True Stories of Sudden Insight to Inspire, Encourage, and Transform. Now, Elise, when you're talking about how serendipity worked in this project and how it works when people have epiphanies, we have there's a phrase here in Fairfield that's very popular that people use called supportive nature. And that sounds like you had a lot of supportive nature on this project.
Yes, I call it, it's interesting. I say it's like the world conspires to support you.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. I have definitely experienced that over and over again with this project.
Now what...
And everyone that talks about their epiphanies has it happen, you know.
What is your definition of an epiphany?
I tell people it's a moment of sudden or great revelation that usually changes your life in some way. That was my definition when I would ask people, when I was asking people about their greatest epiphanies in life, and they would ask me what I meant by it.
Now, you mentioned that you weren't really aware when you were having your epiphany that that's what it was, that it came to you afterwards. Did you find that to be common among people? That they didn't really think of it as an epiphany at the time?
Yes. Some people knew. You know, some people knew this is an epiphany or a life-changing moment. You know, they might... I put all people's different definitions of epiphany in the introduction of the book. But some people were very clear about this was a special moment or an epiphany, and there was a lot of us that, you know, we weren't thinking that when it happened. We realized that's what it was. And sometimes people didn't think about it as that until I asked the question, you know. Well, if you know what I'm saying?
Yes,
they,
I do.
We're like, well, I think that moment would be this for me, you know. So they hadn't thought about it along those lines. But, yeah.
And for some of the ones that I read, it wasn't a specific moment. It was more of a gradual realization.
Right. Some people felt that way, or they could see the way it built up to it. Except that the way that I saw it was that what happens is there was a moment that they realized all that had been leading up to that moment. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And that is the epiphany.
Right.
So some people, instead of it being some miraculous one thing happening, it was a slow burn, and then they had a moment that they realized, you know, that they realized it, that all this had been happening, and then they had changed. Does that make sense? So the epiphany was that moment that they realized this gradual change had been going on.
Right.
And then sometimes people had a change right in an instant.
Right, right. Now, you mentioned that a lot of, you know, originally you were looking for Christian epiphanies because you were working with a Christian publishing or production company.
Well, I wasn't looking for them. I was just getting them.
You're
like
getting
them. I never know when I ask people what their epiphany is going to be, you know. But a lot of people I was asking had epiphanies that were related to their faith as a Christian or becoming a Christian, you know. So I had some of those, but
now are they?
I wasn't pursuing only Christian ones ever, and they didn't have that in mind either in the beginning. They just came to that later and then came back to me and said that.
Are all of the epiphanies spiritual in nature?
Well, you know, some of the people that I interviewed would say no, because they aren't spiritual in nature. You know, they don't have spiritual beliefs. But they all did say that there was something of the mystery, of the magic of life in them that they didn't understand, and they were, you know, glad to have it happen and be a part of it and to contemplate it. But my belief is that, yes, I believe that epiphanies are part of what we would consider the divine, you know, I think that that's what they, I think there's always a little bit of the divine at play. That's my personal belief, because it, to me, the divine is that, you know, magic and that mystery and that serendipity of life, you know, how, whatever you want to, however you want to define that. So for me, I do think it is, but as I say, I can't speak for people who don't have that belief, but everybody spoke to this mysterious, magical quality of life that is inherent in every single one of these experiences.
Now, did you find certain patterns in all the epiphanies?
Yes, well, if an epiphany would change someone's life, it always had these four patterns, these four things that happened. And it was, they were always listening or paying attention, or they were open to the experience. You know, they were always, you know, they listened to it, no matter how crazy it might seem, no matter what other people thought, no matter what. They were listening to it, and they believed in it. The believing in it was the second thing, no matter what. They believed in it, and the third thing was they took action on it. We may not know, in my case too, you take the first step towards taking action on whatever that epiphany compelled you to do, and not knowing, having any idea what the next step would be. Like, I had no idea. I mean, this is a longer one. This isn't my original epiphany, but when I was doing the book, I had no idea what the next step was. I'd never done a book. I didn't know anybody in the publishing world or lit agents or whatever, but I would take a step. I'd make a phone call to whoever, you know, I knew that might know a lit agent, and then, you know, the next step would open up, and the next step, and the next step, and the next step, and that's what happened with everybody. Everybody took action, and then the fourth thing is serendipity came into play. So again, it's, you know, it relates to not knowing what the next step is, but the world will conspire to support you, and the path would be shown, so to speak. And you know, you, it was like the world telling you that you're on purpose. Yes, you're doing the right thing. You know, you should be listening. And what happens is when this happens, it brings you back to the beginning, and you're much more open and aware and trying to listen and pay attention for more of these kinds of moments and directional, you know, signs, you know. So so it's really fun. And then you develop more belief in these moments, and you develop, my experience has been, you develop a lot more belief in yourself. And if you have a faith, I've developed a lot deeper understanding about the divine and about self-love and self-compassion. And I have a lot of epiphanies about that in the book, about their realizations about self-love, divine love, and self-compassion and belief in oneself. And these stories, and working with these stories and listening to these stories and also working on this project as a whole, has really, really been helpful for me in those areas. Those have been where I've really grown. And also, a lot of stories are about healing. And so, you know, these stories are a lot about, I think our greatest epiphanies in life are some of our greatest wisdom. And so in utilizing that wisdom, you just can't help but deepen and enhance your life. That's been my experience.
Now, when you were interviewing people about their epiphanies, was it often the case where people have had many epiphanies, and maybe is it sometimes difficult to choose a greatest epiphany?
Yeah, sometimes. But you know what was interesting is sometimes when what I found has happened, and it even happened in my case, and it happened with several people like Lawrence Wright and Rupert Isaacson and different people, is that they would say, one would come to mind, you know, the greatest one. But then when you're telling that story, that one comes, then you think of other moments also that were really important or just as important or were big ones. But usually everyone knew which one was the greatest at this point in their life. But some people did have other stories about ones that were really huge. And if I couldn't fit them all in the book or sort of meld them together, because a lot of times they build on each other. Maya Angelou talks about that. Your epiphanies build on each other throughout time, and she's right. That's just what I have observed. and what I've experienced. It might not be the same for everybody, but just from the people I've talked to. So, but anyway, they seem to build on each other so that they kind of might have the same theme running through them. And for one, the one comes to mind because I know that I put his other two on the website, which is Lawrence Wright, and he had different ones. And when we talked about them, he said, you know, now that I think about it, I guess, and I said, I go, seems like all of these have a similar theme in that you were growing up. You know, this one led, you know, to the first realization that kind of led you toward a step towards your manhood, and then the next one and the next one. And it was like his were sort of a graduation of comings of age, you know. Mm-hmm. And there were several like that in the book. That's why we have the whole section for it. But yeah, I do think a lot of people have several. Usually they do know which one is their greatest one at that moment when I'm asking them, though. But we do talk about several of them.
Now, Elise, how would you say that intuition is related to having an epiphany? Is there a relationship between trusting your intuition and having an epiphany?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, some people's epiphanies came through what we would define as intuition. You know, there's a whole, Ariane de Beaumaswal talks about that in hers. Hers is called, she calls hers the epiphany of intuition. Mm. And it's that inner voice. You know, people heard voices, and they call it their inner voice, or we had a thought in our head. That's what I had, a thought in my head that seemed to not come from me. Or sometimes it came from them, you know. But absolutely, it's very connected to intuition. Sometimes people had what you would define as a miracle, and they would hear a voice outside of themselves that they couldn't explain who it was or what it was. Some people believed it was an angel or God or whatever. But their intuition, I guess you'd say, told them that that was real, that it wasn't their imagination. So absolutely, I would say that epiphanies many times come through, you know, your intuition and through your inner voice.
Wow. How many different people did you interview for this project?
I don't, you know what, I should go look at the exact number, you know, in the hundreds.
In the hundreds. And how many made it into the book?
58.
And how did you decide which ones to put in?
Well,
that must have been tough.
You know, my editor called it Sophie's choice because she had to do it because I couldn't do it. I'm so every one of these stories has affected my life, you know, and I find them all so important and valuable for me. And we just couldn't put them all in because of room, you know. We only had a certain amount of words we could put in the book per page count. So that's how we decided, but we were in agreement of a lot of them. And, you know, it might be the different criteria was, you know, I don't know, how incredibly powerful they were, how different they were, and, you know, sometimes it just wasn't a discussion. We knew which ones were going in, but it was really hard to at the end, I couldn't decide. We had to cut some that I really loved. So hopefully we'll have another book.
I was going to say, sounds like book two.
Yeah, I hope so.
Now, some of the people in the book are very prominent, famous people like Desmond Tutu, Dr. Oz, Deepak Chopra, Maya Angelou, Barry Manilow, but some of them are people that most of your readers would never have heard of, too. And did that factor into the decision at all about who made it into the book?
Meaning if they were well-known or not?
Right.
Right. Sure. I'm sure it did, you know, for my publisher. I mean, but also I found all of theirs really interesting and strong. I mean, I reached out to people that I admired, and some of the people I worked with because I'm in entertainment, or I'd met them along the way, Deepak, he asked me on his radio show, and so some of the people I knew through people or through work, or and some people I just admired for what they were doing out in the world, and so I reached out to them. Some people were connected to people that I'd already interviewed, like Desmond Tutu was connected to Linda Beale, and I'd interviewed Linda Beale because of an interview I'd read by Desmond Tutu, you know? So, and it was kind of a miracle that he had a last-minute cancellation, and they got me in to him. It was like a miracle that I got him. So it was kind of like that. Again, it was sort of serendipitous who, you know, we interviewed for the book and who we didn't. And then some people like John Layman, who was the Secretary of the Navy under Reagan, you know, he was my best friend from New York's uncle.
Wow.
And it was just, you know, it was like that. It was people I would, and I'm asking people to go to the website and give me suggestions of people whose epiphanies they'd like to know about. So some people I reached out to were because of those suggestions. Some people my friends suggested. Some people my publisher suggested. Some people I, like I said, I just read about, or I've admired them for years, or I've, you know, read their books or seen their movies, or, you know, they've done something that's affected my life directly. I went after a lot of artists and people in the world. You know, I tried to interview Steve Jobs and the guy and the particular scientist who invented the iPhone, because the iPod, because, you know, it affected my life so much. And these are the people that, you know, I'm personally interested in what their greatest epiphanies are, because again, I believe it's some of our greatest wisdom. And people who are affecting my life directly and inspiring me, and I'm amazed and astounded at what they are accomplishing in their lives, not only out in the world and in their careers, but also in their personal lives. I want to know what their greatest wisdom might be, and what the story is behind it. Because also I'm a storyteller, and I love dramatic, interesting stories, you know. So,
Elise, were there some people that you tried to get that you weren't able to interview?
Oh, sure, absolutely, yeah.
But were you surprised at how many people you were able to get through to?
I was, yes. We were so excited, you know. We were really excited to get so many of these people. Like, you know, I just cold called a lot of people, and they were so generous to give these to me. And like I said, sometimes miracles happened and scheduling worked out, and they were able to give it to me.
Yeah,
you know?
I found that on this show, too. You know, it's... We're a local community radio station. Of course, we have a worldwide presence on the internet. But how many writers are willing to give an hour of their time for this? It's just, I'm always very honored by it.
Yeah, people are so generous. Haven't you found? I mean, I wrote that in my book. That was a mini epiphany out of epiphany, is that people are so generous, especially with their wisdom, you know.
Absolutely.
And with their stories, you just have to ask.
And
you
know? And we're in a fortunate position of having opportunity to share that wisdom with other people, you know, to be the bridge between these people who have the wisdom and people and the rest of the world. It's really, I mean, you've done that in your book, and I feel like we do that here on the radio too.
Yeah, so. And you know, I don't know about you. I'm sure you feel the same way. I think in the acknowledgments, I really thank first and foremost the people who, when I didn't even have a project, I didn't have a book deal, I didn't have anything. I didn't know exactly. I had an idea and I had a vision, but I didn't know where it would go. And I couldn't guarantee any of these people that it was going anywhere, and they still gave me their stories, like
wow.
Dr. Oz, like Elizabeth Avalon, like Michael Roizen, like Joel Harper. I mean, Ariane DeBeauvoir. These people are super busy. And Bart Nags, and all, there's like 15 people. Because I needed to collect stories to, A, see if, you know, Epiphanies had some, I wasn't sure what I'd get. I just found them interesting, but I wasn't sure what exactly would happen, or exactly, I had no idea they'd have the impact that they had. I had no idea they'd be so incredibly powerful and inspiring. I didn't know that until I had a lot under my belt. And so because of these people took the time and had the generosity to share with me, some of them didn't even know me. You know, Rabbi Shmuley, Cory Booker, they gave me interviews. Not really even, they knew, I met them through a friend and I heard them speak, and that was it. And these are very busy people that did this for me. And I just find it very moving. And I always will remember it to be able to do that for other people. And And also, just, I'll never forget they did that for me. I'd bend over backwards for them for the rest of my life. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. You're listening to Writers' Voices on KRUU, and we're speaking today with Elise Ballard, the author of Epiphany, True Stories of Sudden Insight to Inspire, Encourage, and Transform. And I have to say that in over 4 years of doing the show and getting books every week, this, I've only had this book for a few days, so I haven't read it all yet, but it's absolutely one of my favorites that I've seen over these 4 years. It's just filled with incredible stories. Yes, yes. I'm in awe of what you've done with this. I mean, and it's in a way, it's a simple idea. You know, it seems so obvious.
Really, it's about these people. These people are amazing. Everyone is amazing. It's renewed my whole faith in the human condition, you know? It's just the people in this book. I'm privileged to be the steward of their stories, you know? So I know what you mean.
So I would like you to read the story of your epiphany, what actually got you started on this. But first I had a question, which now has just totally escaped me. So why don't we go ahead and read your epiphany?
You do that too.
Yes.
Okay, so just read the little excerpt from the introduction about my epiphany?
Yes, yes.
Okay. One morning several years ago, I woke up and realized my life had completely changed. I sat up in bed and looked around me with a mix of bewilderment, shock, and wonder. Scanning the unfamiliar belongings filling the downtown loft I found myself in, it dawned on me just how drastically different my life had become in a few short weeks. Here I was, subletting and living alone for the first time in my life, while my husband of almost 8 years and our beloved cat were still in our home a few miles away. I really am getting a divorce, I thought, and the thin veil of denial lifted and a heavy, suffocating blanket of reality began to sink into its place. And suddenly, I recalled how it happened. I remembered the exact moment that led me to a stranger's home and an unrecognizable life. A couple of months before, in one singular, solitary moment, everything began to change for me. To say my husband and I were in a struggling marriage is probably the understatement of the century. We were both miserably unhappy and had been for a while. We were living in Austin, Texas at the time, and I was the lead actress in a play by Lawrence Wright called Sonny's Last Shot, about the trials and tribulations of Texas politics. I played a West Texas woman who was very much in love with her husband, a rancher and state congressman. My character desperately wants to have a baby. When she discovers that she is infertile, she is devastated, only to find out next from her husband that he has had a one-night stand with a fellow legislator and has gotten the woman pregnant. Toward the end of the play, my character goes to the other woman and asks her to put up the baby for adoption. In the last scene, my character and her husband have adopted the baby. This happens after he appropriately grovels and begs for forgiveness. He was a good guy. He just screwed up this one time. So my husband ends up Speaker of the House, and everyone ends up happily ever after. So when preparing for a role, I like to do as much research as possible into the character's background and circumstances. To play this woman, I researched fertility ailments and treatments and, of course, adoption. I told the prop master that I would provide the adoption agency brochure for my character to hand to the other woman on stage. I will never forget the moment I printed that brochure. I'd done hours of research online about how different kinds of adoptions work and had read all these testimonials from different families about it and had finally found an appropriate-looking brochure to print. As I watched the blank paper getting pulled into the printer and the wet colors of the brochure slowly emerging towards me, I was suddenly struck by a realization. And the word is struck. I was hit. Suddenly, I could see everything clearly. In that moment, I knew that one of the major reasons I was staying in my marriage was because, being in my 30s, I feared that if I left, I might never have a child of my own. This fear was so real and so deep and so terrifying that until that flash of insight, I hadn't been able to even admit it to myself. This fear of mine had, in fact, been paralyzing me from doing anything about my situation. As I was watching the images of the adoption brochure appear out of the printer, my kaleidoscope turned, and the picture of my life looked completely different. In an instant, I was free from my fear of leaving the marriage. I actually felt it lift. It was as if it snapped free of my body. My research for this role had educated me about the options available to become a parent, and in doing so, had uncovered my fear and released it at the same time. Before that, I knew very little about fertility treatments and almost nothing about adoption, and had never really considered it to be an option for me. But now, I realized it was something that I absolutely could and would consider if I needed to. I remember actually thinking, I could do that. I don't have to stay. And when the play's run ended, so did my marriage.
Hmm. Wow.
Do you want me to keep going?
Yeah, keep going a little bit. Yeah.
Okay. A few months later, when I found myself looking around in amazement at my new life, I remembered the moment at that printer and thought, that was an epiphany. The power of that one moment was fascinating to me. It seemed almost miraculous that in literally one moment, I faced both a paralyzing fear and gained freedom from it. That defining moment drastically changed me and also taught me a great life lesson about how I had previously dealt with fear, namely by avoiding it. In this case, not only had acquiring knowledge revealed my fear, but it had also eliminated it and even empowered me. I had decided to make this experience my model. Now, when anything scares me or I don't understand something, I try to educate myself about it as much as possible. Knowledge and understanding, information and education are the keys to eliminating fear. In other words, the cliche is profoundly true. Knowledge really is power.
Now,
after processing what my epiphany meant to me, I was curious to know if other people had experienced the same sort of momentous breakthroughs, and I began asking friends, family, and acquaintances if they thought they had ever had an epiphany. Their answers captivated me, so I decided to ask everyone I could about their epiphany and film their answers. I thought perhaps I could edit the interviews into a movie or at least create a website for them. I even briefly worked with a production company interested in developing the concept into a reality show. But as I was filming and then transcribing and editing the interviews, I realized just how powerful these stories were in written form, and the seed for this book was planted.
Mm. Now, in the acknowledgments at the end of the book, you talk about how this particular journey, where that ignorance is bliss applied even more than knowledge and understanding eliminate fear.
That's right. Yes, when I was writing it, because I had no idea what I was in for. Just because of the intensity, the amount, I mean, it was, I had no idea what I was in for, of the amount of work and the intensity of getting the book done. And had I known what I was in for, I might have chickened out.
And you say that this book represents the ending of a life chapter for you. What do you mean by that?
Well, the epiphany I just read, you started this journey, yeah? So when I had that epiphany, it was 5 years ago, and it led me, you know, to a whole new life. I left my marriage and got a divorce that was very, very painful because of other stuff that I wasn't expecting to happened. And you know, just a series of events, and then this project, has serendipitously kept moving forward, because, you know, I had several projects that I'm always working on, and this is the one that moved forward, and then, you know, it led me to LA and a whole new life, and has led me to healing and to so much learning and, you know, a different way of living. But in doing this, I realized that, you know, that epiphany started that process, and when I ended it, it's, you know, come out in this book. It's like out of the darkness came this great healing and great light for me, you know, and a whole new career and a whole new life. So, and I kind of think that the beginning, me putting this book out into the world, is the beginning of a new chapter.
Wow.
Chapter for me, you know.
Now, at least
I call it that.
You talk about, or you mentioned, we've talked about your filmmaking and now writing, and in both cases you're telling a story, but there must be a lot of real differences between the two mediums. Do you find yourself now drawn more towards one or the other, or do you want to continue doing both?
You know, I'd love to continue to do both. there's something about a set. There's something about the tribe of people that work in film, you know, actors. I mean, I come out of acting, too, which is also a form of storytelling, and I love film, and I love the people involved in film, and I love the process of filmmaking and interviewing people on camera and then working with those edited interviews. I love it. I love film. But I love writing, too. It's a different thing, and you get different things out of both, you know. So I would like to continue to do both, you know. We'll see what happens. But I may end up doing more writing than filmmaking. But you never know. You never know. One thing I've learned, you never know what life is going to bring, right?
Well, it sounds like one of the major differences between the two is that writing is essentially a solitary occupation, whereas
right.
filmmaking is much more of a collaborative.
Yep, and I love
endeavor.
That about it. That's, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm, you know, again, I come out of acting and filmmaking, which is you have to have other people, you know, and I love that. I'm a people person. And so I think this is for my first book that I got to interact with people for the book was great for me. You know what I mean? I'm writing something else that's just, it's a novel, you know, it's not interviewing people, and that's a different thing where it's just coming
out
of you.
Absolutely.
But yeah, you're right. It's a solitary thing. In order to get these done, you have to spend hours getting it done, don't you?
Yes.
By
yourself.
I only got to talk to them maybe, you know, anywhere from, some people's interviews are super short too, but let's say on average 20 minutes to an hour and a half, you know, and then I was on my own to develop these and shape them and get the book done. So it was a lot of solitary time for sure.
Now the book is structured, each epiphany you write an introduction about the epiphany and maybe something about what this person has meant to you in your life, and then you talk about the interview itself, how you obtained the interview, and then you go to the words of the interviewee, and it's in first person then. So you're really, you have kind of a personal essay first, then followed by an, I assume, edited version of the interview. So those are very different tasks to accomplish, that personal essay and the editing of the interview. How did you like do all the editing together, or did you take each interview one by one and complete it and then move on to the next one? How did you go about doing that, and did you find it easier to do one part of that process than the other?
No, I don't find one easier than the other. They're different, but I didn't find one easier than the other. How I would do my work is that I would get I would either transcribe the interview word for word, or I would get a transcriptionist to do it, and then I would take the interview and I would shape it. And one of the reasons I like to, I did all these interviews in person, either on the phone or in person, because I like to experience the way they say it, what it was like for me. It somehow, I think, it seeps into the writing, you know, that if what I experience can go, and I also can interpret what they would say. We speak very differently than how we read.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah, so it was a whole different thing for me to understand and work with that. And you know what? Usually what I did was go ahead and edit the interview so that I could get it down to 2,500 words or less. That was my word limit. And then I would write my introduction I would just freeform, like I do my journals, you know. I would freeform about how I felt about this, how I met them, you know. And I let myself, I never edit myself as I write, ever, the first pass. I just write everything that comes out of me, including when I'm editing my people. I would just cut like the ums and ahs or whatever, and then, you know, and put together, I would put in order the stuff that I felt was the most important, or the, you know, a lot of times we had to glean the main gist of what the epiphany was, because I had to come up with all the quotes that lead the epiphanies.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I would that's how I write. So then I shape it that way. So I would write everything I felt about the interview, about how I knew them, what the story was behind it, because I am a behind-the-scenes girl. Whenever I read a book or see a movie or hear something that I find interesting, I, like, get on the web and, like, go try to read about what that person's like. You know, I want to see their picture. That's just how I am, and I read a lot. So that's why I wanted my book to be something that I would like to read. And so that's why we have their websites, and that's why we have their bios, and that's why we have their all their pictures and their all of that on the web as well, their mm-hmm. photos and their videos, so you could go hear them and then go further if you'd like to research them further. So that's why we did that, because I love that and I like to know that stuff, and also how, yeah, so that's why we did that. And then you know, a book I found too, I know that we do a bulk of the heavy lifting and we have to spend hours writing it, but then you get to collaborate with your editor who helps you a lot. And I had an outside friend that also looked at it for me to help me. You know, I'm very wordy, as you can tell. So they would help me get my thoughts down and edit me down. And so, yeah, that's how I do it. I just write everything I can, and then I go back and cut what's extraneous or what people, you know, wouldn't be interested in or whatever. But I find that's the easiest way for me to write, and it goes faster. And then a lot of times I wouldn't pick what would be in it. I'd say, I can't decide. I find all of this important, or I don't know. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when I write in my own voice, I can't judge it. I'm like, I think all this is terrible. I don't know what to do. So could you let me know? And then that's where the editor, you know, whether it be a good friend or a professional editor, comes into play.
You know, some writers are hesitant about having their work edited, but I find that if you trust your editor and work with a good editor, you're going to end up with a better piece of work when you're done.
I agree with that, and I also would fight back, you know, like if I felt like that she cut something that was really important to the epiphany, rarely did this happen, but sometimes in my introduction I wanted to put something back in, and you know, usually, and I always would give my reasons for it, you know, and usually she listened, you know, she was very, very, we had a really good relationship. Again, I had two editors, my friend that was a professional writer, he would look at stuff, and then she would, and we all had these I had a great experience with editors. I know other people haven't, you know, I don't have as much experience as a lot of people, but mine was great, and I really appreciate their input, and they really helped me. But well, like I said, if I felt really strongly about something, they usually listened, you know?
Now, do you have a favorite epiphany in this book?
I don't. I really don't. People ask me that, and it's just too hard. I love... So many of them have meant so much to me at different times over these last couple of years that I can't pick one. You know, do you want me to speak to some that have meant a lot to me right now?
Yes.
Okay. So Maya Angelou's, to me, really affected me. Hers and Desmond Tutu's, I interviewed them right at the end. I got them under the wire, you know, mm-hmm. these serendipitous occurrences. And so I turned my book in June, and I got these at the end of May. And
wow.
They were both, in some regards, about divine love. And in Maya Angelou's, both of them affected me. I think about them all the time. But Maya Angelou's, is her takeaway line is, we are loved by love itself. There's nothing good that we can't do. And I think about that all the time. I realized that personally, I hadn't really thought about what that meant, what it meant to be loved by love, what it meant to be loved by divine love, what that meant to be part of that. I also hadn't really meditated. I'm not very good at self-love, you know. I've really been working on that, and there are several, Kristen Neff has an epiphany about self-compassion that really has helped me and changed my life. Mm-hmm. You know, she was like, you wouldn't speak to your best friend half as horribly as you speak to yourself. Why do you do that? You know, that was her epiphany to herself, and that's what I do, you know. So, self-compassion, self-love. And Maya Angelou is also, on a bigger picture, whenever I get discouraged or I feel overwhelmed, whether in my personal life or just looking around the world and you hear so many negative things on the news and stuff, and then, you know, she's like, there's nothing good that we can't do. You know, just saying that over and over again helps me be re-energized. And it's like, yes, there's nothing good that we can't do. It reminds me about the goodness of people, about how magnificent we truly are. And I've experienced it, like I've been saying over and over again, but it's true. The people I've interviewed, whether they've done, you know, huge world-famous things in life, or we may not know them except for in our inner circle, you know, my different people I met along the way that aren't world-renowned, however, they are doing amazing things and are magnificent human beings, and everybody is, you know, and that's what my faith in the human condition, as I've said, has been renewed. And I think that her epiphany for me is a mantra that I say a lot, you know, to kind of, you know, there's nothing good that we can't do. And if we're, you know, if I feel overwhelmed by life too, like sometimes I feel like I have so much to do and I'm never going to get it done, you know. So anyway, hers was a big one. Desmond Tutu's about being loved by divine love. Kristen Neff's about self-compassion. David Hudgens, about believing in yourself, this has been a big one for me. He quit his career as a lawyer in Dallas with two little kids in his late 30s and went after his dream because something his sister said, who was dying. And wow. She said, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to look back on your life when you're 60 and regret that you never tried to do what you want to do? And do you know he quit, and his wife was supportive, and he's now one of the top television producers in the entertainment business.
Wow.
You know, and he, you know, completely, most of us are not going to quit our careers, our good careers, in their mid-30s to do what your heart desires. You know, and his takeaway is, you know, you have to believe in yourself. If you don't believe in yourself, no one else is going to. Go for it. You know, and that's kind of what I did in this project and kind of what, you know, I'm continuing to do. So for me, those have been big ones, but all of them have had tremendous impact on my life, depending on, you know, where I was and throughout the one. I mean, G.W. Bailey opens the book with that I think ties together the whole thing. When one life changes, many lives change.
His was one of the most moving ones that I read. It was amazing.
Yeah, well, we're having a book signing here in L.A. on a Thursday, and it's going to be a benefit for the Sunshine Kids. And
wow.
Yeah, he's a. And you know what? He was in the play with me the play that I had my epiphany.
Oh, for heaven's sake!
It's like, do you see the serendipity and the tapestry that life weaves?
Oh, Elise, we are out of time. Unfortunately, I do want to mention that your book is available wherever books are sold, and also from your website. Would you give the website address one more time?
Yes. www.epiphanychannel.com, epiphanychannel.com.
And thank you so much for being with us today on Writers' Voices.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure and my honor. Thank you.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.